I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:32 p.m. on Thursday, March 11th, 2021. Present today are Representative Thompson, Representative LeBon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. Before we start, I'd like to remind everyone to please mute their cell phones. This afternoon, we'll start by hearing from Neil Steiniger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, for an overview of the supplemental budget bills, HB 68 and HB 84. Let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Carpenter. Today's agenda also includes House Bill 76, extending the COVID-19 disaster declaration, which we'll hear in the second half of this hearing. We do not intend to move any of these bills from committee today. Mr. Steiniger, if you'd like to come forward, please. And I'd like to remind committee members that other than the PowerPoint slides, the documents for today's presentation are in the black binders delivered to your office by the finance secretaries. And the relevant documents for today can be found under the Summary tab, the Spreadsheet tab, and the HB 68 Amendments tab. Let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Rasmussen. Mr. Steiniger, please go ahead.
For the record, Neil Steiniger, Director, Office of Management and Budget. We have pretty limited number of slides here. Primarily, we'll be talking about the spreadsheets that are in your binders. But just for some orientation, we've introduced supplemental items for fiscal year 2021 in several different places in our budget proposals. And just for those watching, supplemental items are funding requests, appropriation requests for the current fiscal year, so the fiscal year we're currently operating under. So these generally are things where an unanticipated need arose after the legislature finalized the appropriation process in the prior year. So in this year, we've introduced a fast-track supplemental bill. This was part of our December budget rollout. And this budget bill addresses the most high-priority items, and primarily that's covering capital projects that weren't appropriated in the last legislative cycle. So last year, when the legislature adjourned early, they passed an operating budget that included some capital projects, but not all of the capital projects. Some capital projects we were able to accommodate through the RPL process, but some of them have funding sources that aren't eligible for that process, and so we've introduced them as part of the fast track bill. And we can discuss the merits of each of those individual projects on the spreadsheet. Also in the fast track bill were a couple of other items where there are very urgent supplemental needs or needs that we prioritize for release in December. There's also supplementals included in HB 69 and HB 70, the governor's operating and capital budgets. These primarily are items that are associated with appropriations for fiscal year 2022, but for technical reasons are appropriations effective in fiscal year 2021, and so they fit within this supplemental appropriation definition. HB 84 is the standard supplemental bill, sometimes called the slow track as compared to the fast track supplemental bill. These are supplemental requests we either weren't aware of in December or are for things with slightly less urgency than those items introduced in December.
Let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Johnson.
So slide two, and I believe this is actually my last slide, is a summary of those supplemental items. And you can see it's broken down by where those supplemental requests reside, which bill they are in. That first section is showing those fast-track supplemental items introduced in December. The lion's share of that is in statewide for the completion of the fiscal year 2021, calendar year 2020 permanent fund dividend payment. That's $1.2 billion. The rest is completion of that capital budget. That's at $53.4 million all funds, as well as a handful of agency operating items. As I mentioned, most of the items in HB 69 and 70 are more technical in nature. Here you can see a couple of negative lines, and what's going on with these negative lines in capital, which you can also see in some of the amendments as well. These are situations where we have a capital project that's come in under budget, and so we're repealing that appropriation and then reappropriating it for another use. Here you can see negative $2.8 million or $12.8 million negative on the capital line and a positive on statewide. So what we're doing there is removing a sortie from a capital project that no longer needs it and depositing it into a fund. This table really is giving you a summary that matches to the spreadsheets that we'll walk through if the committee would like to walk through the individual supplemental requests.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steiner, you just said that we repealed it because we were under budget and then we deposited in a fund. Mm-hmm. Which fund?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, primarily here we've recommended the deposit into the Alaska Capital Income Fund. We also have capital requests in the 2022 capital budget, spending out of the Capital Income Fund on deferred maintenance.
Please continue.
Mm-hmm. So direct the committee's attention to the spreadsheet with the header 2021 Supplemental Bill Summary.
Oh, it can be found under the Summary tab in your black binder.
And so I think you should have one that looks like this, which is really just an expansion of the slide that's on the screen. But the one I'd like to speak to is this, which lists out a variety of projects and is 8 pages long. So starting on line 3, this is a supplemental request that addresses school finance and facilities shortfall when the school bond debt reimbursement program was vetoed. Inadvertently, so was the funding for school finance activities, which are funded out of the school bond debt reimbursement program. We've addressed this in the fiscal year 22 budget. This backfills that funding for fiscal year 21 and corrects that issue.
For the committee's reference, we are on the spreadsheet that is under the spreadsheet tab currently. Thank you.
Thank you. Item 4 is associated with several other items that you'll see as we go through. It is a reduction to the amount available for the Alaska Technical and Vocational Education Program funding. The TVEP distribution has been reduced just due to a lack of collections to that fund. And so you'll see budget negative supplemental items to reflect that reduction in collections. So that we don't inadvertently over budget in fiscal year 21 the amount that can be drawn from that fund. You'll also see when we get to the next spreadsheet another adjustment to that estimate that happened after the December timeframe.
We have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steiner, going back to line 3, I understand that this represents a restoration of funds that the legislature wanted to see go forward in that we appropriated money for school bond debt reimbursement. The governor vetoed that appropriation. So the effect of this is that had that original appropriation gone through and escaped the governor's veto pen, the funds, the 928, would have come out of GF, and now that money is coming out of the school fund. Am I correct in that understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it might help if I explain a little more of the complexity in how school finance is funded and or has been funded prior. The facilities section within the Department of Education has been funded through a transfer from the school bond debt program in the past. The school bond debt program is paid for with a combination of the school fund and unrestricted general funds. So in this proposal, what we're doing is utilizing the school fund portion of that to fund the facilities payments. What we found after we made the veto of school bond debt is when we really discovered this kind of historical way that facilities activities have been funded in Department of Education, But not all of those activities are associated with the school bond debt program. Those activities really are associated with maintaining those major maintenance lists and school facilities conditions and working with districts on facilities needs. And so budgeting that within school bond debt really wasn't putting the cost in the program where it's really being really serving. So in the fiscal year 22 budget, we've transferred that out of the school finance or out of the school bond debt reimbursement program and directly budgeted it in school finance and facilities to ensure that that connection to school bond debt doesn't create any problems in future years.
Follow up?
So the net effect of this particular transfer, did any of the municipalities, after the veto occurred, did any of the municipalities benefit from this process, or was it just the state that benefited from this particular process?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the staff that are supported by this $928,000 do work that does benefit those districts. So the work that they do, I would characterize as benefiting the districts. The work that they do is reviewing those applications for school major maintenance funding, reviewing those backlog lists of maintenance needs at school districts, and other work that assists districts and REAAs with facility-related activity.
Follow up?
So then, just to be clear, the idea of school bond debt reimbursement is to help municipalities with their bond indebtedness. Through this particular act, none of those municipalities actually got any help with their bond indebtedness. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's correct. The school bond debt program was vetoed. The activities performed by these individuals that were funded through school bond debt in prior years is not associated necessarily with the school bond debt program. It's a small portion of the work they do.
Just needed that clarification. Yep. Thank you.
Please continue.
So on line 5 is a $13.5 million appropriation for the PFD Hold Harmless program. This is associated with the proposal to complete the fiscal year 21 dividend payment and ensures that the Hold Harmless program is sufficiently funded for its activities related to those that receive that supplemental permanent fund dividend payment. Line 6 and 7 are also related to the TVET program shortfall that I addressed earlier. Line 8 is operational support at AVTEC, the Alaska Vocational Technical Education Center. They've seen significant shortfalls in revenue due to COVID, but COVID relief from the federal government has not been sufficient to offset those revenue shortfalls.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, the PFD Hold Harmless, if the legislature does not appropriate the $1.2 billion to complete the statutory dividend, then does that moot item 5?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's correct. Item 5 would not be necessary in that situation.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Mm-hmm. Item 9, again, is related to the TVET program distribution issue. Moving to item 13, this is moving into the capital numbers section of the fast track supplemental bill. Here's where we'll start to discuss some of those capital items that were not appropriated last year. The first is a replacement system for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. They're currently replacing two of their system servers that are at end of support. That's $230,000 in retirement system funds. Item 14 is $7.7 million in federal receipts related to the Pacific Salmon Treaty Chinook fishery mitigation. This is related to an RPL, but the RPL placed money in fiscal year 21 just for the one fiscal year. This would allow it to move into the capital budget to be used across several years, the full time period of this federal grant. Item 15 is for the Department of Fish and Game, it's $500,000 appropriation from the Capital Income Fund to do maintenance on vessels, facilities, and aircraft. Item 16, also for the Department of Fish and Game, is the Sport Fish Recreational Boating and Angler Access Program. This program is a significant amount of federal receipts, but the match comes from the Fish and Game Fund, which was not eligible for the RPL process, which is why that was not done over the summer. On the next page, item 17 is the Wildlife Management Research and Hunting Access Program within the Department of Fish and Game, which similarly is federal funds matched by Fish and Game Fund, as well as statutory designated program receipts, so third-party contributions to these projects. Item 18 is a capital project to access money in the election fund that was provided under the CARES Act for distribution into the election fund. However, expenditures from the election fund aren't eligible for the RPL process. So we were able to deposit the money into the fund but not access the money. In the intervening time period, the Division of Elections utilized their existing operating appropriation to achieve the goals of election security that these funds were intended for. This supplemental request is needed so that they can then transfer those expenditures to a capital project and maintain operations through the rest of the fiscal year.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, I recall during the summer of 2020, during the RPL period, there were available funds from COVID relief for state elections that we essentially waived, at least at that time. Because I remember talking about this with colleagues at some length. And is this now sort of, is this the same monies that we're sort of getting belatedly, but all the same getting?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson, you're right, these are the same monies. So the way that this sort of came about was in the CARES Act, they included funding for elections for, you know, election activities related to making the election safe for COVID. And the money, the way that the federal grant and the CARES Act directed the money was specific that it had to be deposited into the election fund in each state. The technical issue that is resulting in this supplemental is the election fund cannot be spent through the RPL process. It's not eligible for that process. And so we were able to deposit the money in the fund, but we haven't been able to spend it. So the Division of Elections, knowing that it was a very immediate need to make elections COVID safe, spent money from their general operating appropriations to do that. This supplemental would let them transfer those expenditures into the capital project for COVID security of elections, and then use that money to continue operations. Currently, they're looking at sort of early to mid-April, where they will sort of fall off the cliff of available funding.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So we are on line 19. Line 19 is statewide deferred maintenance. This comes from the Capital Income Fund. You'll notice the amount here, $5.9 million, is significantly less than what's requested in the fiscal year 21 capital budget. That's because there's not enough time left in the year to obligate that much money. The amount here is what's available in 21 that, should the fast track supplemental bill be appropriated quickly, we could start to obligate some projects going into the summer season. Line 20 is $4 million related to prosecutor recruitment and housing to address sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor case backlogs. You'll also see, I believe, $3 million in the Department of Law base budget to, have ongoing support for the salaries of these prosecutors and bolster that activity.
We have a question from Representative Rasmussen and then Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious with the item 20, is that prosecutors that were hired during the fiscal year 21, or are they bringing on extras now?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, the department is looking to create a surge of hiring of new prosecutors to address this backlog and address this type of cases. This capital project would give them the that initial money in fiscal year 21 once it's appropriated. The budget requests in 22 and forward pay for the ongoing salary costs of those individuals. But this helps that kind of initial surge of hiring.
Thank you. And through the chair, do you know roughly how many positions or prosecutors that they're looking to add?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I believe it's 34 PCNs with support staff, but I'll get you the exact number. It's in that order. Yeah.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, I am a supporter of this supplemental item, but not the funding source. How would I explain to education advocates that we should use $4 million of money for a different purpose for this? How would I do that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the use of the higher ed fund in this situation, one of the things as we were building the supplemental budget and as we were building all of the budgets was knowing there is constraint on the balance in the constitutional budget reserve, and also in particular with the supplemental budget, knowing that the prior appropriation bill didn't include what it commonly just called headroom for the CBR draw. So there wasn't available unrestricted general fund headroom to make supplemental appropriations. So we had to utilize some of less than traditional sources of funds. While this isn't a designated use of the higher education fund by any means, and it's outside of that designation, it is still subject to appropriation control by the legislature. So if another fund source were more appropriate, that's this policy is the really the primary thing here is the policy of addressing this backlog. And so we had to utilize what fund sources were available in order to meet these supplemental needs. And so some of these fund sources may not match up perfectly, as you've pointed out.
Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I guess, a comment. Since it is coming from a higher education fund and it may not align perfectly, I think that it actually could be appropriate because of the fact that it's taking up abuse of minors. And I've been told by advocate groups that some of these cases with kids being delayed for, up to five or more years is a very long time, and it's traumatic for anybody, but especially to a child. And that type of trauma could greatly impact them further on down the road, so I see it as a possibility to eliminate some of the long-term effects we might have if kids' cases aren't getting closed out sooner, which, will contribute to their higher education at some point.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I guess the only concern I would voice is, does it impact the UA Scholars, Alaska Performance, or WAMI programs?
I'm through the chair, Representative Lebon. This won't result in a reduction to any of those programs, but it is utilizing the fund source that pays for those programs. But there's no plan to reduce the funding for any of those scholarship programs or any of those other uses.
If I could follow up.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. I guess I can accept that answer, but it's hard for me to reconcile that it won't have some effect long term on those programs in some manner. Thank you.
Mr. Steininger?
Yes. And if I could actually just speak to that a little more detail. The Higher Education Fund is and has for several years been sort of on a trajectory of appropriating slightly more than its earnings. So it is a balance that is over time declining, but over a very long period of time. So this use doesn't undermine those programs, the balance of the fund, you know, is not, it's not a principal and income type of fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess not to make this a debate, but I would suspect that you would take the position that this should be a one-time only event.
Through the chair, Representative Laban, this is a one-time, you know, effectively a startup cost to implementing this prosecution effort.
Thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess I was about to ask what Representative Laban asked. Are there other, I mean, thanks to Representative Joseph for pointing out this fund source and commenting on it. Are there others that we should look out for where you're going into a fund that has a predetermined purpose and you're repurposing it? You know, training prosecutors is not the same as higher education. You know, you can twist it around however you want, but are there other examples of this? And we heard from Mental Health Trust that their funds are being slightly different, but sort of what I would call, you know, breaking the rules, so to speak. Are there other cases of this going on that we should know about?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I think as we go through these items, I will try to note the fund sources and point out where it might be something not used for a designated purpose. Prior to this, one area that we utilized a non-UGF fund source in order to deal with the issue that I mentioned about the headroom in the CBR is line 8, that AvTech backfill. We utilized Alaska Housing Capital Corporation receipts. That's the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation was a fund that was effectively just a savings account with no designation on its purpose. But so we have used a couple of places to avoid that CBR headroom issue in the supplemental bill, utilize some of these fund sources. And I'll try and point them out as we go through and see if there's questions on specifics.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess the other one that came to mind was that there was a PCE fund yesterday that we saw that was being used for something out of their designated purposes as well. So I guess I'm seeing this come up a little bit. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, yeah, through the chair. Mr. Steininger, it almost sounded like in answer to Representative Laban's follow-up, you were saying the higher education fund is suffering anyway, so a little more won't matter. I know you didn't mean it that way, but that's sort of how I heard it.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yeah, that's not exactly how I meant it. It was just to highlight that, you know, sometimes with these designated funds that are being used for a specific purpose, the use of the designated funds makes it seem like it's not a general fund. That's program's not a general fund cost. And in the case of the higher education fund, since that, you know, the real value of the fund is declining over time, you know, those uses still need to be considered as, you know, priorities against other general fund spending. And, you know, those scholarship programs that Representative Laban mentioned are priorities that we've fully funded in our budget, regardless of the declining real value of the fund. So in the case of the higher education fund, the question of the priority really is the scholarship program itself and the services delivered through it a greater priority than the health of the fund? And I think the scholarship programs themselves are the priority. The fund itself is just a mechanism that's, you know, sort of shows it as a DGF cost rather than a general fund cost. I guess that was sort of the point I was trying to make, not well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. If I could just remind the committee, we have over 100 lines to go through, so if possible, if we could hold questions till the end, that would be appreciated. But first, we have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last question, I hope, maybe on this particular topic, but Mr. Steininger, because you've testified that there's been a gradual decline in the overall fund balance for higher education, perhaps you don't know the answer to this question, but with that, has there been any raising of the bar in order to qualify for these scholarship funds, or has there been any noted decline of award scholarships because that previously had been awarded when the fund was more healthy, but because of this decline, are certain kids now losing out where previously they would have qualified for this fund, for these monies?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think I'll have to get back to you on the answer to that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Okay. So moving on to line 21, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. This is an appropriation for security upgrades at the Bessel Readiness Center. There's also, the next line is also for the Bessel Readiness Center for water system sustainment upgrades. On line 23 is the Kotzebue Readiness Center for their HVAC system. And line 25 is roof envelope and fall protection for facilities statewide for the Military and Veterans Affairs. Item 25 in the Department of Natural Resources is the Parks, Land, and Water Conservation Fund federal grant program. Again, this is a program that was included in the 21 capital budget but not appropriated. It leverages a lot of federal funds but requires state match. Line 26 is the Geological Material Center multispectral scanning equipment. This was also proposed in fiscal year 21 but not appropriated. On the next page, line 27, for the Department of Transportation is decommissioning and remediation of Class 5 injection wells. This is $1.7 million utilizing Alaska Housing Finance Corporation dividends. Line 28 is Public Building Fund deferred maintenance, renovation, and repair. This is annual deferred maintenance costs for public buildings that wasn't appropriated in the capital budget last year of just shy of $6 million. Line 29 is court security improvements, improvements for court facilities throughout the state. And line 30 is deferred maintenance improvements for court facilities throughout the state. The first of these, we utilized Alaska Housing Finance Corporation dividends, and the second is Alaska Capital Income Fund, which is a fund source traditionally used for deferred maintenance. Moving to line 34, this is for the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. As was mentioned earlier, this is an area where we've used or recommended the use of mental health trust reserves for a $6 million supplemental for the operations of that facility. And lines 38 is a capital project for the Department of Revenue utilizing $10 million in program receipts collected by the Child Support Division and $15.5 million in federal receipts to replace the aging Child Support Division case management system. In the operating budget, you also see some reductions that they'll be able to take by moving off of the mainframe system. While there is a significant cost to the initial upgrade, there's ongoing operating savings and the system itself needs to be replaced. Moving to line 42, we're now moving into the regular supplemental bill. These are the less urgent items or the items we weren't aware of in December. Line 42 is related to the transition to biweekly payroll. When we transitioned to biweekly payroll, it increased very slightly by less than 0.5% the cost of state employee salaries. In order to accommodate some of those increases in the agency budgets, we're reducing the rate charged by the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations that applies across all payroll through the state. The reason for this is because that transition to biweekly generates efficiencies and savings within payroll processing and HR work. That HR work is being centralized into the Division of Personnel, so all of those savings that offset that salary cost for agencies will be borne in the Division of Personnel. However, those savings will take some time to implement. So in order to ensure that immediate cost impact of that salary increase that agencies are paying, you know, doesn't come at a cost to programmatic delivery, we've reduced that rate immediately. But that does require some backfill of general fund costs within the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations to ensure that their mission is able to be completed. This offsetting cost is still less, or is still represents a still represents some savings over the reduction in rates. So we reduce their rates by $2 million. So there's a $2 million savings to agencies, but they can't implement the full $2 million in savings immediately. So we've had to add $1.65 million in general fund costs within personnel. It's a bit of a convoluted thing, but it's to ensure that agencies aren't harmed by the policy decision to move to biweekly. On line 43, there's $411.7 thousand of unrestricted general fund to offset revenue deficits in professional licensing programs. During COVID, fee increases to professional licensing was suspended, but that did result in some of those licensing boards going into a deficit on their savings, on their license collections. And this is to offset those impacts to the licensing boards.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Chair, Mr. Steininger, why wouldn't this be payable with congressional sources, for lack of a better word? It just strikes me that it shouts out for that.
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, that's a good question. On the CARES Act, on the CRF dollars, they're specifically disallowed for revenue replacement, which this is. In this new package just signed, there's a stipulation that does not allow it to be used for a intentional decrease or a intentional decrease in a tax or fee or a or avoiding a tax increase effectively. And so this was a policy decision not to increase or change fees for professional licensing, which means it's disallowed from use of that fund. So line 44 is a situation. The Department of Environmental Conservation has implemented some energy savings efficiency projects. There's a program within the state that allows you to borrow in order to do energy efficiency upgrades on state facilities if the cost of that debt is entirely covered by the energy cost savings. Department of Environmental Conservation took advantage of this program. However, there were delays primarily due to COVID this summer in actually implementing those retrofits to their buildings. And so in the first year, they're not actually able to fully pay down the debt. $70,000 is the difference between their energy savings and the cost of that debt. On line 45, in Department of Environmental Conservation, and line 46 in Environmental Health and Water Quality, there were unanticipated legal expenditures as a result of enforcement cases that the department must pay to the Department of Law. It's for services for DEC, which is why you see the supplemental in the DEC budget and not in the Department of Law budget. 47 is for the Office of the Governor, Division of Elections, $590,000. This represents the match portion of the COVID relief funding from the CARES Act to the election fund. Line 48 is just shy of $3 million for subsidized adoptions and guardianships. There is a $275,000 general fund match. This represents an increase in the number of kids being adopted or in permanent guardianships. Line 49 in adult public assistance is $1.2 million to adjust for a calculation for the maintenance of effort in the adult public assistance program that is maintenance of effort paid to support the Medicaid program. So this is required in order to continue collecting federal money for the Medicaid program in the state. Item 50 is $1.2 million in federal receipts for increased federal participation in some of the costs at Army Guard facilities for some of the maintenance costs. Line 51 is $130,000 for risk management at the Department of Revenue. It's both physical risk as well as digital risks that they're looking to address. Line 52, also in the Department of Revenue, is an adjustment to the estimate for the investment management fees at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. This $50 million is necessary because they have had higher returns than were initially anticipated when they budgeted their management fees. Line 56 is moving to capital items from the regular supplemental bill. The first is $200,000 for the Alaska Energy Authority Electric Emergencies Program. Line 57 is the Mount Edgecombe High School Master Plan Update, $330,000 from the school fund. The school fund is a truly dedicated fund that can only be used for school facility related purposes. Line 58 is looking to create a new database for school facility conditions that works with the facilities groups at the Department of Education to have a database that will better track those conditions. Line 59 within the Department of Environmental Conservation and line 60 are both related to increases in the match required for increased awards through the Village Safe Water programs, both the expansion and upgrade as well as the first time service projects. You're just seeing the general fund portion here because the department has existing federal authority to collect those increased awards, but they need that match in order to bring that money in. Line 61 is an enhancement to the capacity of the Geological Material Center that's being paid for by a third party that will be utilizing that capacity to store their own samples. On the next page, line 62 is $49,000 for Exxon Valdez oil spill outreach through the Trustee Council. Line 63 is $750,000 to do new subdivision development to bolster land sales by the Department of Natural Resources. Moving to line 69, in the operating language section back into fast track supplemental items, you have $4 million related to outside counsel to support statehood defense, as well as this description is a little bit old. It's both outside counsel as well as other activities necessary to support statehood defense items related to Alaska's statehood rights for natural resources. Line 70 is the...
Mr. Steiniger, we have a question from Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Steiniger, I noticed lots of AHFC fund sources. If I were to talk to someone at AHFC, would they say we're happy to contribute? Or I don't mean to be too sarcastic. I'm seeing a lot of unusual fund sources.
So through the chair, Representative Josephson, the AHFC fund sources is the AHFC dividend that's paid to the state annually. So usually the AHFC dividend gets appropriated for capital projects. By appropriating it for capital projects, AHFC actually is able to hold on to the cash itself and continue to invest it and just pay it out as capital projects needs that cash. So they vastly prefer when we utilize their dividend that we utilize it for capital spending. Last year during the budget process as legislature was closing out, because only part of the capital budget was included, AHFC dividends weren't fully expended. And if they're not fully expended on capital projects, they go into the general fund per the appropriation language. So if we don't use AHFC dividends fully every year, it means we have to take them out of AHFC's account and put them into the general fund, where they'll generally sweep into the CBR. AHFC prefers that we use their dividends for capital projects. That allows them to continue to manage the funds and theoretically should increase dividends in future years. So this definitely is, while they have no necessarily any perspective on the individual capital projects themselves necessarily. It is their preference to see it used in the capital budget.
So, follow up?
Yes, follow up.
So there's nothing about, I'm satisfied with your explanation, and there's nothing about these fund sources that is akin to sort of this, the discussion of the mental health trust fund source or the ADA fund source. This is customary?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's correct. This is customary. That is utilizing their dividend, not utilizing other funds that the corporation holds. And also, thank you for that reminder, as this also is utilizing the Investment Loss Trust Fund, which is another one of those sort of weirder accounts in the state system that sometimes collects money over time and has a small balance that we're able to spend in its entirety here. Moving to line 70 is $1.2 billion to complete the fiscal year 2021 permanent fund dividend. This is to complete the statutory amount from what was paid in July of 2020. On line 74 is $2,300. For a grant to the Blood Bank of Alaska. Line 75 is a reappropriation of a prior capital project to be used for tax expertise and economic impact analysis by the Department of Revenue. As tax proposals are put on the table, the department needs to bring in expertise to analyze those taxes in Alaska's fiscal picture. Line 79 is a technical item related to the Division of Risk Management and the Catastrophic Reserve Account. This was added because basically this has been done in the past. It appears to have been an omission from the operating budgets as we were looking at the Catastrophic Reserve Fund bill that's currently up for consideration. We realize this appropriation is necessary to affect the current statute. On line 80 is an appropriation for smoothing of chargeback rates. These are the rates that were discussed when the Office of Management and Budget was before the committee the other day. Rates charged by various agencies, this provides for, in effect, a sinking fund to stabilize those rate charges year over year. Line 81 is language for the Department of Health and Social Services, Medicaid Services, to allow the extension of saved money in the Medicaid program to roll into fiscal year 22, which allows them additional time to negotiate with stakeholders on the Medicaid budget going towards fiscal year 23. So this utilizes funds that are offset by the increase in federal participation in the Medicaid program to carry into the following fiscal year. Since this has been proposed, that increased federal participation in the Medicaid program has been extended through the end of this calendar year, and so those savings will continue into the next year. On line 82 is an amendment to the commercial vessel passenger tax appropriation. This is the appropriation that sends head tax dollars out to the first ports of call that the cruise ships dock at. When we were reviewing the budget from last year, we found a typo in the year being referenced that would have double spent collections from 2 years prior. This corrects that typo, and while we're correcting that typo, we've adjusted the estimate from the roughly $21.3 million estimated prior to effectively $0, as that's what was collected this last year. Line 83 is an estimated deposit into the Disaster Relief Fund There are several appropriations for COVID disaster relief to the Department of Health and Social Services, totaling $90 million between two appropriations. We're looking to take $30 million of that we do not believe will need to be spent on COVID relief and deposit into the disaster relief fund. That will accommodate known costs that we have coming for prior disasters, not necessarily COVID, but other disasters the state has faced over the last several years, and allow for that fund to be, to bring it back to a healthy balance. Line 84 is the fund transfer that I discussed on our summary slide, $12.75 million of prior capital projects that have been completed under budget, have money remaining, depositing that money into the capital income fund, and you'll see appropriations for deferred maintenance from the capital income fund. And so this money is then redeployed in the capital budget. On line 88, we have a small reappropriation of unexpended balances on capital projects from cruise ship head tax. This money will go back into that account. And line 89 are repeals of other DOT capital projects associated with that deposit into the capital income fund, as well as some repeals of existing projects that were appropriated from the capital income fund, so that money will just lapse back into that fund. Line 93 is a settlement against the state is the Disability Law Center of Alaska judgment against the state is $7.35 million related of general funds and $4.5 million that we will receive from the federal funds in match to the programs created for fiscal year 21 under that settlement. Line 94 are five other judgment settlements or claims totaling $366,000 to be paid with unrestricted general funds. Line 98 is an amendment to the National Petroleum Reserve Impact Grant Program, $17.9 million to adjust to the amount actually received for that program by the Department of Commerce. Line 99 is a reappropriation. This is a technical item, really just to assign old appropriations from that were for the Department of Administration to DMVA now that they have the SATS and ALMAR programs. And all alone on page 8 is a summary line, giving the total of those supplemental items.
Do we have questions from the committee? Representative Ortiz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steiniger, if you could go back to line 82 and line 87, I think. No, that's blocked out, actually. Having to do, again, though, with the commercial passenger vessel tax, the impact of these two transactions, correct me if I'm wrong, will reinstate funds to the cruise ship passenger vessel tax fund itself? Is that what they will do?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, one of them will. The much smaller amount, the $8,600, will lapse back into that head tax fund. The $21.3 million was to adjust the projected expenditures out from last year's budget to what the actual distribution will be. So this is really to true up that appropriation to reflect what's actually available for distribution, which is a very minimal amount that was collected last year.
So then going back to that line 82, you're saying that it was projected that the fund would expend $21.2 million out of that fund, but then those expenditures didn't actually occur?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's correct. So it was projected that we would collect enough head tax revenue to pay out that distribution. Yes, and then that, in the end of session last year, we did not adjust that number.
Thank you.
Yes.
Further questions? Representative Johnson?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, 80 and 81, we don't have amounts associated with them because they are estimated amounts and not they're not additive spending, if that makes sense. So in the case of 81, they're existing appropriations for general fund to Medicaid services. We're looking to use that existing appropriation and extend the expiration date of it effectively. So extend the lapse date of that appropriation for $35 million. On line 80, what we're looking to do is to take existing appropriations, unexpended appropriations in fiscal year 21, and allow them to lapse into an appropriation for rate smoothing. So existing appropriated money, not new spending effectively. So in order to ensure that we're not double counting spending, we don't show numbers on the spreadsheet.
Yes,
follow up.
Line 45 and 46, that would be legal expenditures about the legal expenditure. Can you elaborate just a little bit? Is that against a municipal government, or is that are we talking about an actual private individual?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think I'd have to defer to Department of Law or Department of Environmental Conservation for details on the case itself.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in making sure that where we're expending our legal effort is not to is in the right place to spend it, of course. And I'll go ahead and defer at this point. I might have just one or two more, but thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Steiniger, you were going to go over the amendments first.
So also in your packet is a single page of amendments that were released on February 16th. So first on here, line 1, as well as lines 3, 4, and 5 are all related to the TVEP distribution. So earlier on the last packet, you saw reductions to the TVEP distribution. Subsequent to that release, the department went back and looked at the revenues coming into DVEP, and it's been fairly volatile given COVID and given the employment situation in the state. So those revenues have been volatile. They needed to adjust up. It still is a net reduction, though, in collections to that fund.
Pardon me, Mr. Steiniger. For committee members, this sheet should be under HB 68 Amendments tab.
Line 2 is a fund source change in the Department of Environmental Conservation. Shellfish testing has been funded using cruise ship head tax dollars. It's the opinion of the Department of Law that that may conflict with the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and so we're replacing those funds with unrestricted general fund. You'll see a similar budget item in the D.C. operating budget for fiscal year 22.
Representative Ortiz.
Mr. Steiniger, on that particular item, can you tell me, and perhaps you'll have to save the answer for later time, but how long were cruise ship passenger vessel taxes used for the shellfish testing program? And I guess what I'm saying is, if it's for a number of years, why is it that we're just hearing about this concern now from the Department of Law that it may be inappropriate use of those funds?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I know it's been several years, and I know it's been a concern, and so we're proposing to fix that. I don't know why it hasn't been adjusted in prior years, but we're looking to do so now.
Thank you, Mr. Steinecker.
So again, items 3 through 5 are related to the TVEP distribution. Item 6 is a technical adjustment. Prior OMB reports have reflected some unrestricted general fund costs associated with one of the general fund appropriations to Department of Health and Social Services for COVID relief that subsequent to those reports, we realized those costs should really be applied to federal funds through CARES Act. So that is a technical adjustment to adjust those prior reports. Lines 7 and 8 are more repeals of prior year capital projects that completed under budget. These are presented simply as repeals. And so the first line being repealed back to the general fund, those amounts could be deposited into another fund like the capital income fund. Line 8 is a repeal back into the capital income fund. It's a prior project from that fund, so this could be used for deferred maintenance needs in the future.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make sure, the TVEP funding change, is that just because unemployment insurance fund was less than anticipated due to COVID and unemployment claims?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, it's the TVET fund is funded through payroll taxes. I forget the exact percentages. And given the employment situation over the last year as a result of COVID, it's varied quite a bit off of the initial estimates. The first adjustments that you saw, the negative adjustments, we had put together in December. Subsequent to that, the department saw that the revenues were increasing more than they had projected in December, so you see these adjustments here. So it's a little bit of a, you know, a drop and a bit coming back up. Yeah.
Further questions? Representative Josephson?
Could I roll back, to use a floor term, to the previous supplemental bill summary and ask a question?
Certainly.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, item 94 on judgment settlements and claims, there's $197,000 on the recall Dunleavy. Is that expenses borne by the Division of Elections? And can you explain that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this cost here would be a general fund appropriation to the Department of Law to pay that settlement. So it doesn't run through the Division of Elections budget.
Okay. So what does it say DOE there for?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the information provided here is the, you know, effectively the case name of who the parties were.
So follow up?
Yes, follow up.
So this money is designed to make whole the Department of Law for defending recall Dunleavy?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no, this is to pay the prevailing party from the settlement or judgment.
Follow-up?
So this was within the law and a policy call. In other words, it could have been paid by fundraising or by the state. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this is a judgment or settlement against the state. So it's the obligation of the state to pay.
Representative Edgman?
Yes, on the same page in line 83, I tried so hard not to ask this question, but I just couldn't quite get to where I needed to go. So this item would essentially be a look back, is that correct, in FY21? And if not, can you help me understand, because I'm thinking of Senate Bill 241 and the Disaster Declaration Fund, how we authorized it. $10 million limit, I believe, in Senate Bill 241. And then I think forward to Senate Bill 56 and the measure that's going to be before this committee here shortly, House Bill 76, both of which I believe have been amended, but those as well had a $10 million amount for the disaster declaration fund. So how does this $30 million interplay with all that?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I think it might help the understanding here to, if we provide you a little bit more information about the disaster relief fund and what other disasters have been, you know, making calls against that fund. This is not, the $30 million actually wouldn't be used for COVID-related disaster spending. It would be deposited into the fund to bring the fund back up to a sufficient balance to deal with other disasters that have been happening in the intervening time period as well. There's still costs associated with the Anchorage earthquake from several years ago. There's costs associated with more recent earthquakes and fires, and you know, a variety of other smaller disasters. The Disaster Relief Fund itself, the most recent, and this is a couple weeks ago, most recent number that I was given was roughly $2.7 million in the fund, which is not what they consider to be a very comfortable balance. This $30 million would ensure that they're able to meet the needs that they can see from existing disaster spending in through this following fiscal year. So there is a deposit needed to meet obligations they know are coming from prior disasters, but this isn't associated with COVID-related disasters. The $5 million deposit made last year, kind of associated with the COVID disasters, and the $10 million cap from the Disaster Relief Fund from SB 241, those would not be impacted by this deposit. This is more of a fund sufficiency and an available appropriation that we know is going to lapse. That was also for disaster-related spending, that we saw the opportunity to utilize that rather than letting it lapse to the general fund, put it into the disaster relief fund where it could solve another issue that the state has.
Just as a quick follow-up, and I don't want to belabor this point, but the spending of this $30 million were to be granted would be governed by disaster declarations issued by the administration. Is that a short way to say it?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Steiniger. We're going to take a brief at ease while we prepare for our next bill. House Finance back on the record. Next is House Bill 76, extending the COVID-19 disaster declaration. This bill is one the legislature and the public have talked extensively about this session. I would like to ask committee members and presenters to remember that each committee focuses on different aspects of legislation throughout the process. While there is no doubt this piece of legislation would have significant impacts for the health and safety of Alaskans, our primary focus in this committee will be the bill's fiscal impact to the state and its residents. The Health and Social Services Committee has heard this bill several times over the last few weeks, and co-chairs Zulkowski and Snyder are here to present the committee substitute. After the bill presentation, we will hear from the department. I respectfully request committee members please save all questions until the end of each presentation. Representatives, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and committee members. For the record, Representative Tiffany Zulkowski from House District 38.
And for the record, Representative Liz Snyder, House District 27.
Thank you for the opportunity to present committee substitute for House Bill 76, extending the COVID-19 disaster declaration. Throughout the last year, Alaskans and our global neighbors have faced significant health and economic impacts as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And while the virus has proved unpredictable, with some infections resulting in no or mild symptoms, other infections developed severe illness or led to untimely death. What is constant about COVID-19 is that it is highly contagious, grows exponentially, and new variants pose continued public health risk to Alaskans. Recognizing this threat to the health and lives of Alaskans, on March 11th, 2020, the governor issued a declaration of a public health disaster emergency in anticipation of the spread of COVID-19 to communities across Alaska and issued a number of new disaster declarations throughout the course of the ongoing pandemic. We have come a long way in this last year. The global medical community has improved clinical resources to help those with severe infections. Our society has adapted to how we live in ways that prevent transmission. And the record-breaking development and deployment of vaccine offers us hope on the horizon. But we have heard decisively from Alaska's healthcare and community leaders that we are not out of the woods just yet. And without an ongoing disaster declaration, this prolonged area of limbo is hamstringing response, which has to continue regardless of the ideology in this building about the severity of the pandemic. The Health and Social Services Committee heard from a wide range of stakeholders from across Alaska, from businesses and local governments to epidemiologists and nonprofit service organizations. Testimony was clear and consistent. Alaska still needs the tools to fight this pandemic, keep Alaska's businesses afloat, and help families get back on their feet. We believe this narrow and prescriptive disaster declaration offers that necessary set of tools. This declaration ensures local response in vulnerable communities with limited healthcare resources can continue, enables Alaska to continue surveillance testing at airports to identify cases before widespread outbreaks occur, offers certainty and flexibilities for frontline health providers who remain on the pandemic's front lines, and ensures Alaska remains nimble in its ability to respond. Further, the declaration provides legal flexibilities and meets the minimum criteria by the federal government for Alaska to receive its share of federal funding for a number of ongoing relief and recovery efforts, including vaccine deployment, expanded allowances for telehealth, and alternate care sites for testing, vaccination, and treatment. Delaying or failing to renew the declaration to best position Alaska to fight this pandemic and keep families safe is like taking down an umbrella in the middle of a rainstorm because we aren't getting wet.
Again, thank you for this opportunity to present CSHB 76. I'd like to make it clear that CSHB 76 does not extend the disaster. It extends the declaration so that we can definitively end the disaster. Further, this bill should look very familiar. In an effort to build broad support for the declaration and move expeditiously to meet the needs of Alaskans, CSHB 76 is modeled after the most current version of SB 56, bringing alignment to the Senate companion that has been considered in both the Senate Health and Social Services and Labor and Commerce Committees. The primary difference is reverting to the original sunset date of September 30th, 2021, which this bill allows the administration to evaluate as needed. CSHB 76 is very pared down compared to HB 241, which, as you recall, was passed in 2020, where HB 241 was a large workshop of a wide variety of tools. CSHB 76 is a small, efficient toolbox of essentials to finish the job. We do appreciate that there are alternative ideas and plans to CSHB 76. So in my sectional analysis here, I'll highlight what is unique and why it is important. First, this bill contains important language in that it declares a, quote, public health disaster emergency. If we were to move forward without disaster language, then we are willingly operating in a gray zone of uncertainty. We would be asking healthcare providers and organizations to run alternate care sites for vaccinations, testing, including at airports, and treatment without the protections a declaration affords. Verne Berner, Alaska Native Health Board, on March 4th in the House Health and Social Services hearing testified to this fact. There are already healthcare organizations encountering more red tape and bureaucratic hurdles to set up alternate care sites without a declaration. We heard about this from Jared Kosin from ASHNA also on March 4th. Alaska is risking eligibility for extended federal SNAP benefits without this language, and these extended benefits provide $8 million per month to Alaskan families. We heard about this concern from Kara Durr at the Alaska Food Bank also on March 4th. The Families First Coronavirus Response Act, the federal legislation which allows for the extended SNAP benefits, states, quote, in the event of a public health emergency declaration by the Secretary of Health and Human Services under Section 319 of the Public Health Service Act, based on an outbreak of coronavirus disease, and the issuance of an emergency or disaster declaration by a state based on an outbreak of COVID-19, the Secretary of Agriculture, and it goes on to explain the expanded SNAP benefits. Without a declaration, our eligibility will expire on April 1st. We may find ourselves in a position of forfeiting $8 million of support in April, another $8 million in May, and yet another $8 million in June, for a total of $24 million less in our economy and support for Alaska families. A disaster declaration gives us the nimbleness to respond quickly if things change. We have seen how quickly the trajectory of case rates can increase, as we also heard from Dr. Tom Hennessy on March 4th. Today, with 226 resident cases, plus an additional 12 non-resident cases, this is our highest count since the third week of January. Yesterday was 150, and the day before was 91. The next four sections of CSHB 76 are also addressed separately in individual Senate bills, SB 86, 77, 78, and 24. With a focus on permanency in those Senate bills. This may indeed be a good move for Alaska, but this approach of separately legislating key components of COVID-19 response is not efficient and further delays response resources needed now. So a little information on these four sections. One, provisions for reasonable flexibility and professional and occupational licensing, making licensure quicker until the declaration expires, preventing the raising of fees, and waiving continuing ed requirements. I'd like to note that SB 86, its effective date is not until January 2022. Another section continues expanded flexibility for telehealth services in Alaska. Another section allows shareholder and nonprofit meetings to be held electronically. That's also reflected in SB 24, the previous SB 78. And lastly, allowing certain online charitable gaming activities, which we also see addressed in SB 77. The remaining sections of 76 include provisions for requiring informed consent for vaccinations, as amended in Senate Health and Social Services, civil liability protections for individuals, a financing plan as amended in Senate Labor and Commerce, extending what was issued by the governor on January 15th, 2021, and reporting requirements for OMB. These are reduced as compared to HB 241. So in conclusion, Alaska has done a great job in responding to the pandemic. We lead the nation in vaccination rates and are the first state to open up vaccine eligibility to anyone 16 and older. Case rates have plateaued. These are cause for celebration, but not complacency. Individual and incomplete piecemeal approaches with delayed start dates paired with workaround approaches do not provide the certainty and efficiency we need amidst an ongoing global pandemic. I appreciate we are all emotionally fatigued by COVID-19, but to be clear, Alaska has not been in lockdown in months. And when we had a declaration in place, businesses were open and people have been free to go where they liked. Schools have opened. CSHB won't change this. Instead, it is a way that Alaska can continue testing and vaccinating with efficiency and certainty so we can finally end the pandemic. It is a way for healthcare providers to continue providing needed services without unnecessary risk or prohibitive costs, and for them to adapt quickly as the situation changes. It ensures Alaskans have access to food, and it ensures we can safely promote that Alaska is open for business and welcome tourists who want to help us jumpstart the economy this summer.
And again, in conclusion, we believe that Alaska has done an incredible job, and it is because of the hard work of many Alaskans, especially by those in DHSS, in public health, in tribal health. What's important to us and the state is that we have a way to continue this great work and stay on the right path. We believe the committee substitute for HB 76 is currently the fastest and surest way to do this. Things are looking great, and we want to keep it that way. When the legislature approved the state's first disaster declaration in 2020, it was said that if we look back and it feels like we did too much, the safety precautions and interventions to protect Alaskans from COVID-19 worked. As 4-Acre Group's president, Lori Wolf, eloquently said before the Health and Social Services Committee, ending the declaration now is akin to stopping a 7-day penicillin prescription after 3 days because we're beginning to feel better. Now is not the time to dismantle legal and financial resources that have helped to save lives, protect businesses, and care for Alaskans over the last year. Committee substitute for House Bill 76 provides Alaska with the tools and resources that our municipalities, health systems, and businesses need to get Alaska from where we are today to where we need to go, where Alaskans can frequent local businesses without fear of getting sick, where families and friends can gather in person for life's precious moments, and children can safely continue in-person learning. As anxious as we all are to return to a new normal, inaction on this issue is consequential. Alaska has been more successful in combating COVID-19 in part because we have been proactive, decisive, and responsive. In our communities, public health professionals, and businesses have had the tools to adapt to the world that we find ourselves in. Again, we thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for its time, and we are happy to take questions and to offer our invited testimony when appropriate.
Thank you, representatives. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to find out if the committee substitute that you guys are presenting with the addition in Section 13, the personal objections to the administration of COVID-19 vaccines, was that run by Ledge Legal with no constitutional or federal issues, and is this relating to people regardless of where they're employed? Does it only apply to state employees? I'm just trying to understand that a little bit better.
Sure, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. So that language was an amendment that was offered in Senate Health and Social Services, I believe, and the intention was to provide statutory protection for Alaskans who opt not to receive the vaccine.
So what type of protection, I guess, is it protection against, I'm not quite sure what the protection is, sorry.
That's okay, sure. So For the record, again, Representative Zilkowski, so through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, our understanding is that the intention behind that was to ensure that there were statutory protections that do not force any Alaskan to receive the vaccination. While we are under the understanding that this is not language that's necessarily required, that this exemption, there's nothing in statute that requires anybody to receive any sort of vaccines. Again, this was offered on the Senate side with the intention of making sure that that is indeed the case with the COVID-19 vaccine. And again, most of the reason for the committee substitute was to bring alignment between the existing House bill with the changes that had already been made on the Senate side.
Follow up?
Thank you. I actually really appreciate the language, and I just want to verify, because I am hearing about cases where we have private employers here in Alaska requiring employees to vaccinate, and they are required to show proof of the vaccination, which I personally would think is a HIPAA violation, but and they've given them a date at the, I believe, end of August, in one of the companies that I was told about, that they have to put in personal leave or resign from their position if they choose to not participate in getting a vaccination. So I do think that it's very important. I've heard concerns about airlines requiring vaccinations for people to fly, and I do want to make sure that Alaskans maintain the option to vaccinate or choose not to. That's their preference.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, ladies, for your presentation. On that same page, page 10, under civil liability, it reads a person may not be held liable, and then reads on for actions, et cetera. During the emergency declaration, if a private sector business is open for business and is deemed an essential operation, and one of their employees gets the virus, is there a liability protection for the business, particularly since we don't know necessarily where the employee obtained the virus infection? Could have been away from the business location, could have been brought into the business location by a customer or client. Is there an element of protection for a small business owner in this?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, that's a great question. Again, we would refer back to the summary of changes on the original Senate bill, in which this particular language was brought forward and this particular section was added. Our understanding is that this provides that a person may not be held liable for an action that does or does not comply with an order, proclamation, or declaration adopted by the governor. Our reading and understanding of this, through the chair, Representative LeBon, is that this would be a rather broad waiver of that liability. But again, for the record, I am not an attorney, so I would happily run that through legal services to verify.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
I'm not sure if this is a question for the co-chairs or for the two co-chairs at the table before the committee, but this is a governor's bill, and it's not my time on the committee. I've seen chair of the committees come forward, but generally it's on personal legislation. Why do we not have a representative from the governor's office presenting a governor's bill?
It's my understanding we have individuals from the department on the line today, and I think we would defer to them to answer that question, if we may.
The administration will be presenting immediately after the representatives.
So through the chair, the response is that the co-chairs are presenting the bill because it was most briefly in their, it was most last in their committee, or, I mean, I'm not going to make a fuss out of this, but this seems to be out of the convention of presenting a bill. And I just needed to know if this was any indication that the administration may not be supportive of this bill or not.
The co-chairs asked that they could present the committee substitute, and then we'll have the administration address it after they're complete. Representative Zulkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Edgman, I would say that an assessment would be accurate, and again, as Chair Merrick indicated, that the administration is online, but from my perspective, co-chairing this particular committee and watching this legislation as it's an area of significant interest and concern to stakeholders that routinely come before health and social services, is that there's been a very fast evolution of position on this issue by the administration, believing that the legislature needed to extend the disaster declaration, which is where the genesis of this particular bill came from, to opting not to extend the disaster declaration, to pursuing, as Co-Chair Snyder mentioned, a number of pieces of permanent legislation that stand separate from a disaster declaration. I believe that's contributing to the awkwardness of our willingness to present the bill, and I think would be an indication that the administration has wanted to distance itself from the declaration, but I don't want to put words in the department's mouth. I will say that from the homework that we've done as co-chairs of this committee, it's been made very clear to us by staff in Senator Murkowski's office that standalone legislation that's not a disaster declaration is not sufficient for leveraging the federal resources that are coming from the federal government for COVID-19 relief. And so we continue to believe that a disaster declaration, since there's not a statutory opportunity for a public health emergency through Alaska statute, is the best way to move forward to ensure that we have the legal and financial flexibilities and resources to continue to respond to the pandemic.
Madam Chair, I asked the question as well because considering a bill that, there seems to have been several iterations on this by the administration, and that's fine. Things are happening quite quickly with the distribution of vaccines and so on and so forth. But at the same time, to know that this bill, accompanied by its companion, Senate Bill 56, was introduced, and then the governor basically said, look, I think we can accomplish all this without a disaster declaration. We don't really need a disaster declaration, and I would ask the administration officials to correct me if that's misstated. The fact that there was an abbreviated bill being brought around the Capitol building, and now we're back to the original bill here in the House, pushing that through. And I just want to know if I'm working on a bill that's either supported or not supported by the governor, who can ultimately veto this if we did pass it. I think that's a germane question, and I'll save that for the administration when they testify. And I do have, Madam Chair, and I won't ask the question now, but I do have a number of questions in the financing section of the bill, which I think is directly relevant to this committee.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zulkowski, I believe you, in your testimony, you said that the version that we're looking at right now is a pared-down version of the original disaster declaration. Can you summarize, if in fact that's the case, can you summarize the main impact of how or what the impact of that pared-down version is compared to the original version, or the original declaration, I should say?
Representative Ortiz, we can speak a little bit to some of the components of SB 241 that were not that are not included in this one to help get to that question. Things that were in 241 that are no longer in 76 include some specific language regarding the chief medical officer declaring health orders, allowing the commissioner to do so if the chief medical officer isn't available. No longer included are some more detailed monthly reports submitted to the Senate President and the House Speaker, including detailed budgets and activities. That's no longer a component of the required reporting. Previously, peace officers, firefighters, EMTs, medical technicians, paramedics, and other health care providers were going to be presumed to have contracted COVID-19 at work if they were exposed and test positive.
There was some PFD and eligibility language. There were some protections regarding rent, foreclosure, and utility moratoriums. There were some rules against price gouging, and there was also some additional language around financial assistance to prevent homelessness as a result of COVID-19. Those are components that are no longer in 76.
And I realize you had just gone through that information previously, but I guess my question is, the net effect, can you just give me a summary statement as to the net effect of the fact that this is a pared-down version? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can do that or not. Maybe it's just too broad, but
You can go if you want.
So, again, Representative Zielkowski, for the record, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, and we brought invited testimony that will zero in specifically on this. But I do want to indicate that the flexibilities that come into this are testing at airports. Alaska has identified 3,000 cases of COVID-19 through airports. We also have testimony from Petersburg in which they'll talk about the impact of COVID-19 in their community, specifically since the disaster declaration lapsed, and they've seen some of the highest numbers in this period of time without a disaster declaration than they have in all of last year. And so Dr. Hennessy is positioned to speak to some of those things.
And a different question? Thank you. And on a different note, and again, I think your comments from one of you spoke about the idea of telemedicine. I have a constituent text message here today that they wanted me to wanted me to know that right now this particular person was informed that they could no longer receive telemedicine from an endocrinologist in Seattle because there is no extension of the declaration. If we were to pass this particular version, would that problem go away?
To our understanding, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it seems to be three issues that I've heard thus far that we need to hear from the administration or some other authority. One of them is the federal money is at stake issue. I've heard rumors that that is the case, but talking with the administration, I believe it not to be the case. So we need to definitively understand that from the administration's point of view. Second, whether the governor wants an emergency or needs an emergency declaration in order to resolve this issue is another thing that we need to learn. And three, are there other bills in the pipeline to address this, these issues raised in this bill that are acceptable and solve the problem without having to declare an emergency? Those are three things that I think we need to figure out before we waste a whole lot of time on this.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, you mentioned airport testing. I couldn't find the language, so maybe it's referred to another section. But it sounds like one of the things that's restored with this bill is mandatory airport testing for people coming into Alaska. Is that true?
Good. It provides the flexibility. So when we're talking about alternate care sites, that is how we are facilitating the testing at the airports. Right now, without a disaster declaration, we don't have that flexibility. So we've heard from healthcare providers and health organizations that without that protection, they're continuing some of these services, but it's a bit of a gray area, unprecedented. And I bet you want to add something to that.
Yeah, thank you for the record, Representative Zielkowski, and again through the chair, Representative Wohl. In addition to the alternate care sites, as Representative Snyder mentioned, they also have closed down drive-through testing sites around the state, which has closed down the opportunity to do surveillance testing and asymptomatic testing and wider testing gives a better snapshot of where the virus is in Alaska and can help public health officials predict how it's moving. It also offers more of an opportunity to do increased genomic sequencing so that we know the variants and the higher virulent versions of the virus are moving throughout Alaska. And so it's pretty fundamental in being able to identify cases early before they get into a community and cause widespread outbreaks, and that's what we have invited testimony to speak to today.
Follow up?
I think I heard the answer. So this bill will restore mandatory testing at the airports for people coming into Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, as I understand it, it provides the authority to the administration to be able to mandate testing at airports.
Thank you. And follow up.
Follow up.
There was a period that those coming into Alaska needed to quarantine for a certain number of days before they could mix with the population. That's not the case right now. Will this bill change that? Will there be any quarantining for those coming into Alaska, aside from the testing? Because I knew that it was mandatory, and I think that was a good program, especially those coming in from, only for those coming in from out of state, especially with new variants of the virus. But is quarantining addressed in this bill?
It would not be required, but it would allow the flexibility should that need be deemed necessary.
Thank you. And last one. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. Reading this language, it looks like, is it changed from a declaration to a disaster emergency? Is that a intentional word choice there? So it's no longer a emergency declaration, or is that still, disaster declaration?
I think some of these terms get used a little loosely, and we use disaster declaration as a sort of a shorthand. But what's reflected in earlier legislation and what remains here in 76 is the phrase of public health disaster emergency.
Follow up.
Thank you. So that they're the same thing. By using emergency instead of declaration, it still has the same legal implication. It's not, you can't say, oh, it's a different category it's a new thing now. It's still the same thing.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, to our understanding, yes.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was circling back to the comments made by Representative Carpenter. The telehealth issue that Representative Ortiz is highlighting is actually a major issue, and I'm not sure, as the co-chairs of HESS, if you're currently pursuing long-term, permanent is what I was looking for, permanent changes in our statutes so that in the future Alaskans who have a provider out of state have the ability to utilize telehealth. And I guess in addition to that, I can see why we would need to do it the way that we are right now, just based on time. I think this is probably the quickest avenue, and for the things that should be permanent, as Rep. Carpenter noted, to be working on those as quickly as possible. But I mean, even a couple weeks for some patients is a very long time to not be able to see their provider. And so we got to get it moving along quickly, I think.
Thank you, representatives. If your testimony is complete, we will hear from the administration next. Heidi Hedberg, Director of the Division of Public Health from the Department of Health and Social Services, will provide statements from the administration. Ms. Hedberg, welcome. If you'd put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, good afternoon, Co-Chair Foster and Co-Chair Merrick and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, and I serve as the Director of the Division of Public Health in the Department of Health and Social Services. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to provide some comments related to House Bill 76 today. So House Bill 76 was introduced by the governor pursuant to Alaska Statute 2623020. This provides that a disaster proclamation may not remain in effect longer than 30 days unless extended by the legislature. On January 15th, the governor issued a declaration of a public health disaster and emergency in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. A bill was transmitted to the House on January 21st proposing to extend the public health disaster emergency to September 30th, 2021. This is the bill before you today. Absent legislative action and pursuant to state law, AS 2623020, the public health disaster emergency issued on January 15th expired on February 14th. In the time leading up to February 14th expiration, we met extensively with our response partners to include our federal agencies, local governments, healthcare providers, tribal health entities, healthcare facilities, and associations, to discuss operations and response efforts by the state and to determine impacts if the disaster declaration was not extended. Based off of the feedback, the administration evaluated the current COVID response plan, which includes elements which you are all very familiar with, I am sure. And they include that widespread testing, supporting non-congregate housing for certain groups of individuals who need to quarantine or isolate, providing alternate care sites, procurement of personal protective equipment and testing supplies, guidelines for Alaskans and non-residents traveling to and through Alaska, contact tracing, guidelines for critical infrastructure workforce and employers, and vaccine allocation, distribution, and administration. To continue to keep Alaska one of the safest states, we are requesting limited authorities as we maintain the robust testing, contact tracing, vaccine administration and distribution, and response to community outbreaks. As part of our evaluative process, we looked closely at the authorities that are available to the governor under the Alaska Disaster Declaration Act. And I would like to review the authorities under the Alaska Disaster Act with you so that we can walk through what it offers and how we used them and what we need. AS 2623020B states, the governor may issue orders, proclamations, and regulations necessary to carry out the purpose of the Disaster Act. This was used to allow state agencies to be nimble and flexible in response to the public health emergency and disaster. It also provided protections to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19 by establishing guidelines for travel into Alaska, around Alaska, and for our critical infrastructure workforce. The AS 2623020E is a proclamation of a disaster emergency, activates the disaster response and recovery aspects of the state, local, and interjurisdictional disaster emergency plans. This authority was used to allow the unified command structure, which is the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Health and Social Services, to support local jurisdictions, the healthcare system, and coordinate the statewide response to the pandemic. It also allowed the establishment of the alternate care sites, including the outpatient therapeutic treatment centers, and establishing the vaccine point of dispensing clinics, and allowed for the state to coordinate the logistics of supplies and materials. AS 2623020F, the governor may delegate or assign command authority for the National Guard by appropriate orders or regulations. And this allowed us to utilize the National Guard for response purposes such as contact tracing and logistical support at our warehouse. AS 2623020G, and there are many authorities under this statute, a number of which we used in this response, and I'll go over the ones we used and the ones we did not use. So number one was the suspension of provision of regulations or statutes if compliance would prevent or substantiate negatively impede or delay action necessary to cope with a disaster emergency. We used this statute for emergency procurement of supplies for hospitals, clinics, and communities, and emergency procurement for contracts for cold chain shippers and testing and supplies. We also hired temporary personnel to support public health response plans, and those were, contact tracers, public health nursing, microbiologists, and support for our data systems. This statute also allowed for the increased flexibility in how we care for and provide services to our most vulnerable populations in congregate settings and facilities. Number three is the transfer of personnel or alter the function of state departments and agencies or units of them for the purpose of performing or facilitating the performance of disaster emergency services. We basically used this statute and repurposed the entire Division of Public Health to respond to COVID-19. Number seven is control ingress to and egress from a disaster area. The movement of personnel within the area and the occupancy of premises in that. This is the authority that we use to implement the pre-travel testing requirements for travel into Alaska and to communities off of the road system and the marine highway system. Number nine, which is makes provisions for the availability and use of temporary emergency housing. This was used for non-congregate housing for homeless and for travelers that arrived in Alaska with a positive test result. And then number 10, which is allocate or redistribute food, water, fuel, clothing, medicine, or supplies. And this is the authority that is used for allocation and distribution of our personal protective equipment, testing supplies, vaccine, and therapeutic treatments. Now for the other authorities that are in Section G that we did not use. And there's four areas that's good to highlight for your awareness. The first is we did not use the available resources of the state government and of each political subdivision of the state as responsibly necessary. We did not commandeer or utilize any private property. We did not suspend or limit the sale, dispensing, or transportation of alcoholic beverages, explosives, or combustibles. And we did not use money from the oil and hazardous substance release response account to respond to a disaster related to an oil or hazardous substance discharge. In summary, not every single authority available under the Alaska Disaster Act was used or needed for the COVID pandemic response. Authorities that were used were not used necessarily at the same time. They were some authorities that we used early on in the response, but not later. And there was authorities that we used later, but not earlier. And there was a number of authorities that we've used consistently throughout the response. Through our evaluated this process, we've realized that we do not need broad authorities available under the Alaska Disaster Act to continue the COVID response and transition into recovery. The Department of Health and Social Services believes that there's room to utilize a more limited or targeted approach by using uncodified law to establish specific authorities that we do need and that are important for our response and recovery plan and for a limited period of time. So here are the authorities that we have identified. And again, this is based off of feedback. And as one of the incident commanders, I can tell you this is truly the authorities that we need to continue to respond effectively to this response and transition into recovery. The first is to allow the Department of Health and Social Services to continue to coordinate, allocate, and distribute and manage the state of Alaska vaccine and therapeutics for the COVID-19 response. These are still scarce resources. The second is to allow the Department of Health and Social Services to cooperate with the federal government with respect to the blanket waivers, the 1135 waiver, and Appendix K authorities, and the application and distribution of SNAP emergency allotment, also known as EA benefits, as part of the state's response to COVID-19. Third is to allow the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to support and assist the Department of Health and Social Services. Fourth is to allow the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to receive delegation of authority from the governor, allowing activation of the Alaska National Guard to assist with segments of the state's response and recovery plan. Fifth is the allowing the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to coordinate with FEMA to maintain the funding for non-congregate sheltering capabilities for local jurisdictions across the state. Sixth is to provide the authority for the use of telehealth and telemedicine for healthcare providers currently licensed in good standing in another state. And then finally, to provide immunity from liability for a governmental entity, employee, or person who's engaged in performing duties as part of the state's response to COVID-19. We understand the sensitivity of using the disaster declaration and a public health emergency to provide such broad authority. We also understand the need to progress as we are in this response and starting to pivot into recovery for Alaska. We need to have the tools if we need to respond. As you will hear, there are some communities that do have outbreaks, but we do have other communities that are moving into recovery, which is why we want to make sure that we have the necessary limited tools and that we can, if it's going in the wrong direction, we can use those necessary limited tools. It is possible to allow the appropriate authorities to the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs to continue the state's response plan without providing the broad authority of a public health emergency disaster declaration under the Alaska Disaster Declaration Act. We respectfully request that the House Finance Committee to consider providing identified limited authorities to continue Alaska's response and recovery plan without the issuance of an extension of a disaster declaration. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster and Co-Chair Merrick. I'm happy to answer any questions. In addition, I just wanted to let you know that we do have several other staff that are with me today to help answer some of those questions, to include Brian Fisher, who is another incident commander. He's also the operations manager with the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hedberg. We also have online Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the state, and Suzanne Cunningham, Legislative Liaison to the Department of Health and Social Services. We'll begin with Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I asked this question of the co-chairs of Health and Social Services, and I'll ask you, Ms. Hedberg. The mandatory testing at the airport that is now voluntary, and you I'm not sure you addressed it directly, do you support, especially with the introduction of new variants of COVID coming from different parts of the country and the world, where does the administration stand on mandatory testing for those coming into Alaska from outside of Alaska?
Thank you. And through the co-chairs, Representative Wohl, I will share with you, as I am the one that helped stand up the testing at the 10 airports that received flights from the lower 48, that it is a very good strategy in that we have identified close to 3,000 positive cases through that option of testing. What I want to make sure everyone understands is that there's a lot more, we keep saying the word tools, but there's a lot more options available. We still continue to say that testing is an important tool. We recognize that there are a lot of individuals that have also recovered from COVID. And if you recover from COVID and you're within a time period, you don't need to test. As well, if you are fully vaccinated, which means 2 weeks after your last dose, that you do not need to be tested as well. So it is up to the legislature to decide if they want to include that as part of this bill. I would also like to mention that when the disaster declaration expired on February 14th, all of the infrastructure stayed in place. There was no change to the infrastructure. What changed was the health alerts, or health orders, my apologies, changed to advisories, and now it is optional. Again, giving the option and educating travelers and Alaskans the importance of what this provides in early detection.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think what I heard you say is you helped stand up the program. You detected 3,000 cases coming in. It is an option. What I mean is it's one of the things you can do to detect COVID from incoming people, but you're saying it's up to the legislature if they want to make it a mandatory program, but right now it's optional for those coming into Alaska and coming into the tourist season, well, hopefully a tourist season, and with many new variants out there. I mean, I would postulate that one of the reasons Alaska has pretty good COVID results is that we were testing people coming in, and other sort of island or quasi-island communities like Hawaii or even New Zealand that are able to isolate people coming in have done pretty well, and I would include Alaska with that. So I guess, and Canada doesn't allow you to drive through very well, so Alaska is really only accessible by air and possibly cruise ship this summer. I guess I'm concerned about that and I understand what you're saying about people that have been vaccinated or people that have tested positive, and maybe there's some workaround on that, but I think it's a good program. And anecdotally, I know people that have flown in since the mandatory testing requirement was lifted, and very few people coming in on flights from Seattle, for example, opt to get the test because they really just want to get their bags and go. So. It concerns me, and if there is an uptick, especially of new variants coming in from out of state, I bet that could be the source of the uptick, and I think it's a good program to look into continuing, at least for a little while. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the last 2 minutes of your presentation, you covered civil liability, and at least I think I heard you talk about protecting state workers from liability for any COVID-related incident or illness. Does this overlap to protect a private sector business that was deemed essential and is operating under that label of an essential business to protect that business from claims that might originate from clients or employees or other individuals that frequent the business?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Laban, that's a great question. And it's my understanding that we do have a representative with the Department of Law online, and I think they are the best person to answer that question.
Suzanne Pollard? Are you online?
Yes.
Thank you. Please put yourself on the record.
For the record, this is Susan Pollard from the Department of Law, the Assistant Attorney General. And through the chair, Representative Laban, I believe I understand your question to be in regards to Section 12 of this bill and how it would potentially affect civil liability for potentially private employers. Is that correct, or would you mind repeating your question?
No, I think you're correct, and it's just that Section 12 civil liability my impression it's talking more to protect the state and departments and employees. Does the declaration include any private sector employer protections, or is it all public sector?
For the record, Susan Pollard, Department of Law. Thank you for the clarification, Representative. Through the chair, my understanding of Section 12 is that it was added in the other body with the consideration that this bill, or in the other body, SB 56, would have had an effective date of February 14th. And if the bill was effective after that, we would need to have a retrospectivity sort of indication for folks who, like, took actions either in compliance with what had recently been sort of the mandates of the health order, or who had not, because the disaster order had extended. I do not believe that the sort of the detailed consideration that you're asking about private employers or potentially private sector was really contemplated, and so I can't give a clear and absolutely firm answer at this point. Thank you.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
For the record, I am willing to take follow-up questions, but again, that's my recollection of how Section 12 was drafted. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Quick, just follow-up. It seems to be absent in all of this any consideration protections for private sector employers via any claims that might originate from clients or employees or others when they're trying to provide an essential service. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and we'll conclude with a final question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hedberg, thank you for your testimony, and I particularly appreciated the end part of that testimony, which included, quote, the things that Health and Social Services Organization and the administration need going forward in our continued attempts to control COVID. So would it be your assessment then that the things that are included in House Bill 76 will meet those needs? In other words, does the administration support this bill because it does in fact meet the needs of the administration going forward in dealing with COVID?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Ortiz, the administration has taken a stance that we do not need a public health emergency or disaster declaration to continue on. What we need is limited authorities. The bill, as it is written, does provide what we need.
So it provides what you need, but you don't endorse it, or you don't support it?
Yeah, through the chair, thank you for that question, Representative Ortiz. It's all of the authorities that we need are included in House Bill 76. I think what we are doing in the administration is saying that there's some authorities in there that we do not need. And as we are truly a year into this response, and as we have built up a lot of capabilities and worked really hard with communities collaboratively, we are asking for a limited set of authorities that we believe can be created in uncodified law, a separate bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hedberg, and thank you to Co-Chair Zulkowski and Snyder for their presentation today. We can continue this discussion at a later hearing, as we are over time for today. Our next House Finance meeting will be Monday, March 15th at 1:30. Tomorrow's meeting will be for the UA subcommittee. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 3:44 p.m.